Hello, it's Scott Manley here, and today I want to talk about the massive solid rocket boosters, which were the backbone of the Space Shuttle, and will continue to do so for the SLS. These were the largest and most powerful rocket propulsion systems ever used in flight, and they're getting even bigger for SLS. When I've talked about rocket propulsion systems in the past, I've often focused on liquid-fueled engines and their complex plumbing and high-pressure pumps, and sort of dismissed solid rocket motors as being relatively simple because they don't really have any moving parts, but of course that is far from the truth. These are incredibly high-tech items that were developed back in the 1970s and were continuously improved even before the Challenger accident forced them to take a hard look at certain features of the booster, but we'll get to that later. At launch, the boosters accounted for more than half the mass of the Space Shuttle stack. Each booster was about 600 tons and the total shuttle stack was about 2,000 tons. Each booster would generate about 1,250 tons of thrust, whereas the core would only generate about 600 tons. So these boosters for the first 2 minutes of flight would provide about two-thirds of the thrust needed to get the vehicle up and moving. Even before that, the boosters were critical because the entire structure was anchored to the launch pad through the boosters. There were 8 massive bolts that would hold the boosters down with frangible nuts that would be detonated at T equals zero. Simultaneously, the igniter at the top of the booster would be triggered and the booster would start running, and it wouldn't stop running for the next 2 minutes, no matter what. The propellant was a hard, rubbery substance made primarily of ammonium perchlorate, which covered about 70% of the mass. There was about 16% aluminium powder, which would provide most of the energy for the combustion. There would be a tiny amount of iron oxide to act as a catalyst, and all this would be bound together by something called PBAN, because saying polybutadiene acrylonitrile all the time is quite a mouthful. This material would be mixed at a factory and then molded inside the solid rocket motors, and they would have a material around the outside with a hole down the entire length of the booster. When the booster lit, the combustion is happening on the internal surface of this, and the hot gases are escaping down this interior channel toward the nozzle at the far end. The boosters were originally manufactured by Thiokol. The contract was awarded in the mid-1970s. Now, they are based in Utah, and they needed to move the boosters, which were very large, to Florida, which meant the boosters weren't moved in a single piece. They were made of multiple pieces, which were joined together in Florida. So the main booster casings were constructed from cylinders of steel. They would be 3.7 meters in diameter and about 4.5 meters long, and about 12 millimeters thick, made of a very high quality, high strength maraging steel. They would take 8 of these sections and join them together in pairs using a factory joint, which would be permanent, and then they would fill each section with the material. But there's a little more that goes on than just pouring the propellant in. First of all, there is an insulating layer on the outside. It's about 4.5 centimeters thick, and it's a like asbestos-filled rubber. That was what they used on the Space Shuttle. And this, is, of course, isolates the interior of the booster from the steel, stops it getting too hot, isolates it from vibration and electrical currents and things like that. Now, for the SLS, they are actually replacing this with a new material because asbestos has many problems. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen tests of the booster rockets that are going to be used on the SLS, because they need to validate the new materials. There are some other insulating layers interior to that, but they're pretty thin. Then you have the bulk of the propellant. The propellant layer is just over a meter thick, although this varies depending upon where you are in the booster, because the thickness will help control the burn rate during the flight. But that means there's a fairly wide section in the middle, wide enough for somebody to crawl down if they were, you know, crazy. At both ends of each section, there is a layer of inhibitor material added. This is like an ablative heat shield that stops the propellant from burning on the ends. There's a gap between each segment in the booster, and if hot gases flowed in there, then you would have extra combustion there. They don't want that, so they control it with a material that will essentially ablate away and control the combustion to only be along that interior channel. On the very front segment of the booster, there is an 11-pointed star that is cast into the structure. This will burn faster early on, giving them a little boost at launch, and then those vanes will burn away and the combustion will slow down a little, which, of course, helps them by reducing the thrust during the point of maximum aerodynamic pressure, or max Q. This section also includes the ignition system, which is up at the very front of the booster. The way it works is it's essentially a very small rocket booster. It's actually a multi-stage system where you have a pyrotechnic igniter, which ignites a bigger charge, which blows hot gas down the middle, starting the booster. And this happens in a fraction of a second. And since triggering this is the point of no return, there are many locks to make sure this doesn't happen by accident. There's actually a physical pin that has to be pulled out before the system can even be used. That pin stops the hot gas channel from rotating into position. So if a stray electrical charge triggers this while they're setting things up, it can't actually start the booster. Somebody a couple of days before the launch has to go into the nose cone of the boosters and essentially pull out this pin to make sure the boosters are armed and ready for flight. In front of this, the booster also has most of the recovery hardware, including the parachutes, separation rockets. It also includes a set of rate gyroscopes to detect booster motion. These are independent from the gyroscopes on the space shuttle itself. And of course, having separate readings from both of the boosters was critical in figuring out what happened to Challenger, since the rate gyros from each booster started to show very different values seconds before the destruction. Now, if we move to the aft end of the booster, you of course have the nozzle. Now, the nozzle has to interface to the rest of the pressure casing, but the nozzle also has to move. So the nozzle moves on a two-axis pressure seal joint that can handle the 60 atmospheres of pressure and the thousands of degrees of temperature. And this bearing is made by having many layers of plates that are essentially sections of a spherical shell. So these are stacked on top of each other, and then they're joined together by a rubber-like layer, but it's of course a rubber that can handle the temperatures and pressures. So each layer allows a small amount of lateral motion, and overall the whole nozzle can gimbal by about 8 degrees. The nozzle is moved by two separate hydraulic actuators, which are at 90 degrees to each other to provide a full range of motion. The hydraulic system is pressurized by two separate redundant hydraulic pressure units. These are self-contained power units. They have a hydrazine fuel supply which decomposes, drives a turbine, and then that pressurizes the hydraulic system. So they can handle a failure of at least one of these. The nozzle also has a nozzle extension attached to the back of it, which of course improves the efficiency, but just before the boosters land in the ocean, this is removed, it's severed by a pyrotechnic device, and you'll see that sometimes fall to the water separately from the main booster. So a lot of this hardware is contained inside another component called the aft skirt. That will also include some of the avionics, and it includes the aft separation motors, which are used to push the booster away from the spacecraft. The aft propellant section also has some extra features not seen in the other segments of the booster. It has extra reinforcement rings because this booster is one of the places where it attaches to the external tank. Running vertically up the side of the rocket, you'll also see the electrical tunnel, which contains your cables that need to run the length of the booster to communicate between the front and the rear. But you'll also find the explosives for the flight termination system, which runs down the side. If they're going to terminate the flight of the booster, then the charge splits the thing along its length, and that, of course, stops the thing flying as a single mass and reduces the combustion. Of course, one time this flight termination system was actually used was on Challenger. After the breakup of the stack, the two boosters kept on going under their own power and had to be destroyed in case they went somewhere where they shouldn't. So let's talk about the joints. As I said, the booster on the shuttle was made from four segments, and each segment was itself made from two separate sections of steel. Now, the sections were all joined together by a clevis tang joint, and this is where on one side the steel would split into two and form a Y shape, and on the other side the other piece would slide into the gap and then a pin would slide through. Now, if you have this in a complete cylinder, on the wall of a cylinder, you have many pins that go all the way around. Now, mechanically, this is a very secure joint, but it isn't pressure sealed. So to stop the hot gases from the inside coming out, on the interior side of the clevis, there's a pair of O-rings that were added in the original design. And these would go around the entire circumference, and when the interior was pressurized, these would get pushed into the gap and stop the gases leaking through. The O-rings have to have some flexibility because this is a mechanical system, and when those boosters are firing, they are bending and flexing under the loads. During early part of launch, these boosters are sort of flapping back and forth like strings on a guitar, 3 or 4 times per second. So the factory joints were generally more secure because interior to those, there was a continuous layer of insulation and the liner. But the field joints, which were assembled when the booster was being put together on the pad, those necessarily had a discontinuity in the insulating layer. So as they were assembled, they would put a putty around the outside and that would push itself into the gaps. But of course, the gases were expected to push past this. The O-rings were still very much the primary protective system. So in the case of Challenger, it was very cold and those O-rings didn't respond fast enough to fill the gap. As the booster was oscillating, it would find one side would be under tension, and as those joints were pulled under tension, one side would get peeled away just because of the shape of the mechanical coupling, and that would pull those joints with the O-rings wider, and then as it was compressed they would get pushed back together. But that, of course, in that moment you would let gas get by and it would start to erode the O-ring. As Challenger was leaving the pad, the cameras recorded puffs of smoke 3 or 4 times per second, consistent with the oscillations of those boosters. But this smoke actually stopped after a few seconds, and you know, Challenger might have safely made it to orbit if it hadn't been for another factor. But 37 seconds into flight, they started to experience wind shear, and it was the strongest wind shear on any shuttle flight. So the boosters are now having to correct for these aerodynamic forces. They're working much harder, and of course, these forces that are being translated into these boosters, causing those joints to flex again. And at some point, the joint again starts to come loose and starts leaking, and that's when we start to see the real erosion happen and the jet of flame start to shoot out. And that flame, of course, damaged the external tank and it damaged the coupling to the external tank, and eventually tank starts leaking, the booster comes loose at the bottom, and the vehicle, it breaks up under aerodynamic stress. So, of course, the Challenger investigation happens, Richard Feynman does his amazing pop science experiment, and a number of recommendations are made to fix these joints. So first thing they did was on the forward side, they add a new flap that stops the O-ring section from being pulled away as tension is applied. On that, they add a third O-ring as well. The pins are lengthened, and on the outside, they add a retainer ring to hold the pins in place. And to this, they also add a heater to make sure the O-rings never get too cold. And on the interior, they redesign the insulation so that there's something called a J-slit. And this is a gap in the insulation layer at the back. And what it's designed to do is the hot gases will flow into this gap and push the slit apart. And this will actually force a section of insulation across the gap and therefore increase the seal, hopefully. It'll act as like another pressure seal helping to protect the O-rings. So these changes were made and the boosters flew largely trouble-free for the rest of the shuttle program. And of course, they're now being re-engineered for the SLS program. There's lots of subtle changes to materials. The O-rings now handle low temperatures, which means they don't have the heaters to keep them warm. The insulating material no longer contains asbestos. And the boosters are now 5 segments long, providing for more thrust and a longer burn time. They are still using steel casings though, while many modern solid boosters have switched over to use composite or filament wound casings. But the space shuttle actually looked at filament wound casings very early on. Back in the early days of the space shuttle, they really wanted to launch the space shuttle into polar orbits from Vandenberg, and because it wasn't launching eastwards, they needed to have a bit more performance. So there was a program to develop these lighter boosters using modern composite materials. Unfortunately, of course, that program shut down when Challenger happened. There were more pressing concerns and the space shuttle never launched from Vandenberg. There was one other rocket that flew with this booster design, and that was the Ares 1X that flew back in 2009. The Constellation program, of course, was planning to use these to deliver cargo and crew to the space station, back in the days when many people didn't trust outside contractors like SpaceX to do the same thing. To be honest, the Ares 1X wasn't much of a launch vehicle. It was all boilerplate with the exception of the main booster and a single unit that provided roll control. Everything else was a dummy. The booster wasn't even a full 5-segment booster that was supposed to be used on the real thing. And it, you know, lifted off and showed that, well, a shuttle booster can indeed lift lots of mass, but it was a very expensive launch for not even a fully functioning launch vehicle. And commercial vehicles are doing this so much cheaper these days. So these big, dumb, solid rocket boosters that propelled the space shuttle and will carry the SLS are by no means low-tech items by any means. They are very much the product of rocket science. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.